Okay. What I'm going to do is sort of follow Sarah's lead, but I'm going to sort of divide it up a little more, and I'm going to focus first on the process of our SEOW, and I should mention we're the state epidemiology and outcomes worker. We added the O part. Some of the states are doing that. And then I'll talk a little bit about some of our findings. Just to give you a little idea, we are a cohort two state. We are funded in 2006. We were funded in 2005. The governor's office received the money. It took us about 6 months, actually, to get organized. I was actually approached in early 2006, January 22nd, to be exact. I was summoned to the governor's office for a very 7 o'clock morning and meeting, which was interesting. I didn't know what was going on. When I was approached by about 12 different politicians, all of whom asked me to serve as the chair of the SEOW, I felt like this was a serious clandestine move. I didn't know what was exactly going on, but I realized after I left the meeting it was kind of an important moment. And I was actually really delighted to take on this challenge because as a medical sociologist and somebody who does a lot of work in public health, I really was excited about the idea of actually using data to drive policy, and that was such an unusual experience. I'll say a couple... it's in Indiana, at least, it's an unusual. Maybe it's different elsewhere. The purpose, as it is in most of the other states, was to review the EPI information to basically figure out what's going on in Indiana and improve that understanding and derive data-based recommendations. Now, like the other states, we actually, and there's lots of acronyms that are floating around this whole SPIF-SIG process, we actually have what's called the Governor's Advisory Council, or GAC, and I like that because it's sometimes makes me realize how I feel about them. I should mention that there's 49 members of the GAC, and they're chaired by the sheriff was until about a month and a half ago, who was appointed by the governor during his campaign. And this is important for the political context because the sheriff was responsible for the largest meth interdiction in the history of Indiana the same year the governor was campaigning for governor. So that, I don't think, was an accident politically. And when I heard about that, I was a little nervous about what that meant for the whole political process and how open it would be. I'll mention that he actually resigned a month and a half ago to pursue his political career, which, again, sort of reinforces the political nature of this process. So we report to the GAC, although most people in Indiana now say the SEOW drives policymaking in Indiana. I'll come back to that in a little bit, which has been a nice sort of achievement on our part. I brought with you the names of the individuals, not because they're important, but I wanted to sort of highlight a couple things about the composition of the group. First off, there are 20 members officially, and it fluctuates a little bit. We have a lot of what we call ex officio or non-voting members. These are the voting members, although I am not a voting member. I'm chair of the SEOW, but I also am an outsider to the process. And we discussed this. Part of the reason was because when we got the grant, I was asked to both direct the evaluation piece and also chair the SEOW. And when we were deciding whether this was ethical within the federal guidelines, the only way this was, we felt, ethically permissible was, in fact, if I was a non-voting member for the whole process. And that actually has turned out to be really very strategic. And I would strongly encourage you to think about having a leader who actually does not have a vote, because it forces a dynamic that I think has helped us in many ways. In this list, there are 8 state agencies, all of whom have different access to data. There are 3 university groups, I would include myself in that, and 1 community agency who are all represented. In addition to that, we have a bunch of non-voting members, many of whom are basically attached to some of the other groups. We also have Sheila Nesbitt from Central CAPT, who's a technical consultant who does a good job of coming to our meetings and cajoling us when we're not following the rules or doing something that we shouldn't be doing. One of the things that's real critical here is we actually have, as part of the grant process, a support team, and this is really important, 2 of whom are here, Harold Corman and Miriam Green, who are actually really sort of the worker bees, if you will, on this whole process, and we sort of really are the team that runs the data analysis. And this is really important because, as I'll come back to a little bit, some of the challenges we faced are, in fact, in resources around actually data analysis. So some of the key analytic challenges we faced, these are probably not terribly surprising to most of you if you've been working in this area. First off, there was limited data. And if you remember, Renee was talking about sort of the challenge here was to figure out how we're going to allocate funds to individual communities, which itself was a definitional issue. We focused on counties because Indiana has a dubious distinction of having one of the most number of counties in the state in the United States. We have 92 counties, which for our small state is actually quite a bit. And we have very little data, actually, what's going on in individual counties. And this is really, from the very beginning of the process, was a challenge in trying to help us think about this. We also faced a couple of practical challenges that I think are also sort of understated and not discussed a whole lot. And that, if you remember, those 8 state agencies that are represented in the SCOW were invited to be on the SCOW strategically, because each of them represents an agency has this big reservoir of data that has to do with substance abuse related issues. We had a hard time, partly because we were outsiders, but also because historically there's a lot of tensions, which I'll come back to in a minute, across these state agencies. But in order to bring all these data sources together to bear on this issue, we really wanted to have an organizational structure that served as a bridge across these agencies, and so that was really important. Then the issue of resources I mentioned was really important, and this has actually turned out where we have been really instrumental in sort of making this work happen. The states typically, and maybe this Indiana is no different here, maybe it's very different, but we tend to fund, at least at the state level, staff only to collect the information and do the mandatory reporting to the federal government. There's very little time in this day of any of the data analysts in the state roles to do anything pretty much other than that. And that means that there's a lot of data that sits around and basically collects dust, or whatever the equivalent is in electronic format. But the reality is there's just no resources to actually analyze the data. And then finally, there's a lot of perceptions, and this is sort of the political quagmire about what the quality and quantity of the data are. One of the things we ran into is if you ask the Indiana State Police, of course, the arrest record data was the best thing since sliced bread and tells you where the cutting edge of the whole system is. If you have the Department of Mental Health and Addiction, it's the treatment episode data. That's where the rising tide is. And there's a lot of interesting debate, and what I realized when I was listening to them argue about this, and I could every once in a while do a good sociological thing and sort of step back and try to figure out where these people are coming from, I realized they were basically arguing across each other, and it was really largely a set of turf battles that represents a couple of key differences in terms of how they think about the world. So if I want to sort of talk about some of the political challenges, there's quite a few. The first one is this tension that I just alluded to. They really do have different worldviews about sort of how the whole problem of prevention is. And I would argue that none of the systems are talking about prevention to begin with. If you actually ask criminal justice, I mean, they're talking about enforcement or deterrence as their mode of prevention. If you ask the mental health people, they're really talking about treatment. And that's pretty much the way they think about this. And when I step back and think about this as a researcher, clearly prevention is happening. Those are downstream, if you will, sort of consequences of these things. So a key problem in this whole political process was getting them to think about upstream processes and to connect to how these data do or do not tap well into understanding what those upstream processes are. And so one of the things that we did a lot was, and they didn't necessarily notice this, but when I was sort of re-gearing, changing the I would actually simply moderate these conversations where I'd say, well, you know, that's true, but what's leading to that? Again, if you think about the causal logic of the SPIF process, all I was doing was negotiating a different way of thinking about it. And really, I think what it did was actually begin the process of actually bringing these policymakers together to think about prevention in a more accurate way, as opposed to always the downstream kinds of consequences. Another challenge here was, in fact, the organizational separation in agencies. Governor Evan Bayh, who many of you may have heard about, he is apparently Hillary's first choice for vice president, but when he was governor of Indiana, he actually did a lot to actually bring together physically the state of Indiana. That we were spread all over the city of Indianapolis, and so all the state agencies were in different places. Well, then they all moved in basically the same couple of acres. Still, but they're very much siloed and very administratively separate. Okay. Funding streams are very separate, and they don't really have any reason to talk to each other. And that was really kind of amazing to me. Here you have these 8 different state agencies that have oodles of money to talk about various prevention things, and they're not talking to each other. And so these administrative and policy challenges really created a whole lot of confusion. And here I would argue that part of the problem was not only turf battles, but confusion about who should be the lead agency around prevention issues. And so basically these physically separate organizations were all trying to sort of do things. And so you have different agencies that were trying to do things. DMHA, for example, the Department of Mental Health and Addiction, was sort of really pushing Afternoon Rocks as the front end of the prevention system. Then you had the Department of Education, which was pushing drug-free schools. And so everybody thought they were doing prevention, but no one was talking about how these things work together. And that was a really major challenge. And I think one of the things that happened, and I'll come back to this in a minute, the SEUW prompted a conversation about what are the relationships among these processes. And of course, external pressures, when you talk about politics, are always present. The governor, as I alluded to a minute ago, campaigned it on methamphetamine abuse. And I'm happy to say he's actually starting to look at the data. Which I think is a major success in this regard. But in fact, it was a huge political issue, particularly in southern Indiana, which is a very, very, very conservative part of the state. And that was actually what swayed the governor's election, was southern Indiana. And so he felt very much a commitment there. And I also think it's important to acknowledge the role of CSAP. We actually sort of got a little renegade-like and decided to do things a little bit differently, and we got slapped a couple of times by CSAP and said, no, you can't do that, so we had to go back. That was actually really nice for us because it helped the GAC think about sort of the larger political context and how that process worked. And so it's just an interesting process. So how did the SEUW help to overcome these? And here I want to sort of spend, where I want the meat of the presentation. First off, I think it's important to acknowledge, and not just because I'm an egomaniac, but I do think that my role as an outsider was absolutely really critical here. As a non-voting person, I could tell people that they were full of you-know-what. And I tell them, basically, that I could see these fights happening all the time. And so what I would end up being is basically a referee. And that was all my role was. It was kind of fun, because it was like having someone asked me, what was it like to chair the SEUW meetings? And I said, it's just a rowdy graduate seminar. I mean, that's all it is. And so I actually transferred that skill to the state government, and it worked really well. And I think that was really interesting because all I did was basically refocus on the issue of prevention, sort of thinking about the causal processes, and then I kept asking, where's the data to support these things? And no one ever asked those kinds of questions in the political process. And so just by asking that question really did change the conversation. I already mentioned the issues of resources here, and I think this is it's not just having the staff, it's also having staff that have the competence that everybody can have faith in what's going on. We actually recentered this whole process at my center, the Center for Health Policy at Indiana University, and we had done a lot of work for different state agencies, so we had garnered a reputation of being objective and capable of doing pretty high-level stuff, and I think that really did have a lot of faith in terms of sort of quelling some of our political critics. And then the other piece, which, again, Renee sort of alluded, there's lots of data laying around, but the key here is turning data into information that people can use. And this was where, in fact, the primary focus was on talking about the data and figuring out what it meant, and that is turning it into information. And here's a key piece of this. The shared nature of the construction of this information was really critical, because by having a public conversation about what the CJ data said, what the DMHA data said, and what they meant, we actually ended up doing what social scientists often refer to as triangulation. We kind of compared and looked for the most robust patterns in the data and looked how different patterns showed up in different data sources, and how we focused our attention was really on those that showed up in multiple data sources, which made it really hard for any single agency to argue that this was not really accurate. And at first we heard about, when we started this conversation, it was really kind of funny. It felt like it was, again, the Rowdy Graduate Seminar, because I heard about different agencies arguing about, oh, that Eric Reich, he's actually, he's not doing his job. And then the next thing I know, I hear about these rumors, and then I come back to the meeting and say, here's the data. You know, it's really interesting. That stopped after about the 6 months process, just by staying very focused and very boringly focused on the data. I kind of think of this as the equivalent to scientific peer review. I call it political peer review, because basically what we ended up doing was having all the political players at the table, and their representatives were represented, and if they didn't show up to a meeting, which happened a couple of times, and they were perturbed about a particular conclusion, of course I heard about it, but the next meeting we basically said, so and such agency doesn't feel like this is a judgment, and then they basically pursued and have a nice little argument. And so it ended up basically becoming a consensus statement of sorts. And I would actually happy to say it really is a consensus statement in our product. And then political accountability. We were very public. We have our formal voting members, and we're very religious about who can raise their hand or say aye. But the meetings are open to the public, and we've had people drop in just periodically just to see what's going on, including the governor's health policy advisor will drop in periodically just to check up on us. And, of course, I get really nervous when he does that. But it's really good because it, again, sort of establishes political accountability. And I'm happy to say that there's a number of indicators of success. This was funded part of the SPFSIG process, and there's been a number of changes just in the last few months about that indicate sort of the value that the state of Indiana is putting in this. And first off, our sphere of influence is now growing. I've now been asked a couple of times to present to other governor's councils. In fact, the most recent one is the Secret Committee on Meth, that has actually been reevaluating the data on meth. And the governor hasn't announced this, so you guys get a preview about this, but he's actually going to come out and basically say the war on meth is over. In Indiana, because there's such success, and the data is very clear about this, and then now what we need to do is focus on comorbidity. Now, this is in, if you haven't read our SCOW report, you will discover that, in fact, what's really going on in Indiana is we're really very close to the top of the nation in terms of multiple drug use, okay? This is a common pattern in Indiana. Well, it's because of the conversations the SCOW has had, the governor's going out on a political limb and basically saying, we don't need to pay attention to meth anymore. We need to talk about comorbid drug use. And that's a really big change for the governor. Very much a data-driven decision, and it's really interesting how little secret meetings you get called to about these things. The political process is always fun. Another indicator of success is, in fact, that we're no longer SPIF-funded. The state of Indiana, after the first year of the SCOW, has been switched to the block grant dollars, and the director of the Division of Mental Health and Addiction has told me, quote, you will have this until you retire, unquote. Okay, that's 25 years from now, at least. So I think they've made a commitment to using this process, and they've actually really felt there's a lot of value in this process. Then also, another thing that's happening, and this actually will happen literally next Wednesday, is as part of the funding that each of the communities got, they were allowed to form LEOWs, Local Epidemiology and Outcomes Work Groups, although they have LACs, too. So we have LACs and GACs and LEOWs, SCOWs. See, that acronyms get really obnoxious. But what we're doing in this, we'll now have 12 funded communities, each of which will have an LEOW, and we, as the SCOW, are having the first LEOW statewide training. And we're going to basically begin a conversation about having basically coordinated data collection at the local level that will all feed into the SCOW. And basically the goal here is to have 92 LEOWs in Indiana, one for each county, looking at these data, reporting to the SCOW so that we have a really good understanding of what's going on at the local level, which was our biggest limitation. And then lastly, I think this is also really exciting. Actually, I got the email yesterday, but the state is now going to fund a recommendation that came directly out of the SCOW. And that was, in fact, that we have no systematic data on what's going on at the county level. They did one survey about 5 years ago to actually estimate the county level what's going on. And we've actually asked, recommended, that they need a statewide data system that allows us to actually monitor this for the future. So they have accepted our proposal that we should do a biannual survey in Indiana. And this is directly an SCOW-sponsored proposal. And it was voted on by the membership and went all the way up and they're finding the money to do this on a biannual basis into the future, which is really, for our point, very exciting. And I think this is all testimony to the potential that an SCOW could have in terms of bringing folks together. 5 minutes, thank you. Just to give you, this is our copy of our SCOW report, which I'm happy to say we published last year in September. I got some copies if you'd like a copy. It's also available on our website. Our 2007 edition is literally at the printer. This is our second edition. It's also currently available online if you'd like to look at the 2007 edition. So you can help yourself there. We did have six priorities, and I just want to mention a couple things about how we prioritize. These are our six priorities, and this is where we got slapped by CSAP. The GAC was very committed to having six priorities, and they wouldn't budge on this. And I said, I think about the resources. SPIFSIG resources are too limited, but they really were committed to the idea of having these six. And so it wasn't until CSAP basically came back and said our state plan was inadequate, we had too many priorities, we wouldn't be focused enough to be effective, so you had to come to some sort of decision about reducing them. So we ended up coming up with a prioritization matrix, and this is where we actually went through a process of debating some of the qualitative criteria that Renee was also mentioning. We applied sort of the existing capacity and resources. Again, Arkansas did this as well. We ruled out tobacco from the very beginning because 80% of the prevention dollars in Indiana were being spent on tobacco, so they were off the table. The second one we eliminated was marijuana, and that was because there's not a lot of good, well, there's low political will in Indiana to do anything about marijuana, and there was also not a lot of information about doing preventability or changeability with regard to marijuana, so we felt that that was kind of would be a high challenge for us. We then finally came to the conclusion that we should also eliminate prescription drugs for the similar reasons. It's a huge problem, actually. The data are actually really suggesting it's a growing problem in Indiana, particularly in the northwest corner of Indiana around Chicago. But when we looked at the data, it was like nobody knows exactly what to do with it or how to sort of deal with it from a prevention point of view. And there was not a lot of political will yet, although there have been a couple of noticeable overdoses in northern Indiana, which has sort of increased that. And I think that's going to come back in the 2007 process. And then finally what we ended up doing was focusing on alcohol, cocaine, and meth. And because we had data on the different priorities, we actually allocated 60% of the SPFSTIG dollars to alcohol, 20% to cocaine, 20% to meth. Now, just to give you a little contrast about sort of how we did this, we sort of used the highest need, highest contributor model. We blended these. Highest need, basically, we defined as basically being the numbers of cases of a particular type. Highest contributor, we used the rate. This sort of allowed us to compare the 92 counties. And we did this by focusing on a series of core measures. In alcohol, we had six core measures. We took basically the arrest rate and the number of arrests for DUIs, the arrest rate for possession, for public intoxication, and for both arrests and rates, number and arrest rates, and then fatal alcohol accidents. We basically then assigned them a priority score based on where they were in terms of the rankings, and then the counties all got a score, and then basically ranked them from the highest to the lowest, and basically we drew a line somewhere and said, basically, these counties, we have the SUW judges to be of high need. We didn't have as much data for cocaine or meth, so we ended up focusing primarily on the arrests for possession, and we felt these were the best proxy levels at the county level to come closest to our priorities, and that was why we focused on there. And I always like to point out, because I am an IU faculty member, that Tippecanoe County, which is where Purdue University is, always ranks in the top three on all measures across this. So something's going on in West Lafayette. You're supposed to laugh. Okay. Just to wrap up, I think one of the things that our sort of experience suggests is that really this interagency data analysis group really is a critical political feature, and I have decided that this is actually a really good model, and I know some of the other states have started, or some of the other states' agencies have actually started thinking about how they would do this. The Office for Medicaid Policy and Planning, for example, has started pulling welfare researchers together. I'm not part of that group, but I know they're modeling this on that sort of our similar model. And I think one of the things that we learned here was having the outsiders was really important here, because I could be a broker across the state agencies who were very much intense. And I think we would not have done this without SPFSTIG funding, and the resources are really critical to being able to do this work. So, again, if you're interested in getting a copy of this, I have a few copies up here. Thanks.
Thanks, Eric.